today, as protests intensify in response to the killing of George Floyd, we look at the unjust policing of black men and women in America. Before we start, there may be some distressing descriptions in this episode and some swearing. Paul, can you describe what you saw when you watched the video of George Floyd being killed and what you felt?
What I saw was an African-American man like me whose life was being extinguished.
Like, bro, 3 minutes, bro. He's not fucking moving. Bro, he's not even fucking moving. Get off of his fucking neck, bro.
When a police officer put his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck.
I also stand here to grieve with my community today. With all the black people all throughout this country, all throughout America, and right here in Minneapolis, we feel as if there was a knee on all of our collective necks.
And Mr. Floyd narrated his own demise.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
He said, please, please. He said, I can't breathe. He called to his dead mother.
Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up!
I saw unspeakable cruelty. This was an arrest about a fake $20 bill. How did I feel? I felt traumatized by it. I think as a black man, it's impossible not to take that personally, to think that that could have been you.
If you want change in America, go and register to vote.
The principle here that you need to be focused on is Black Lives Matter. I do not feel safe in America.
I'm a law professor. I'm a former prosecutor. I experienced that video as a black man. I can't watch it. I remember it, but I can't watch it every time I talk about it because it damages me.
The hurt and exhaustion that you can hear in the voice of writer Paul Butler is being echoed right now across America. Listen to the protesters in Minneapolis, Atlanta, New York, Washington, D.C., L.A. and beyond, and you'll keep hearing the same thing. People are tired.
We are tired of officers being able to literally get away with murder. Right. While our community faces so much over-policing.
And we're so tired of marching and protesting.
I'm mad as hell. I woke up wanting to see the world burn down yesterday because I'm tired of seeing black men die.
That frustration is being expressed in different ways and has built into the worst civil unrest in America since Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. But in 2020, the outrage isn't just about one man dying at the hands of the police. It isn't just about George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, Philando Castile or Alton Sterling, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown or Eric Garner. It's about a pattern of behaviour that appears to be on repeat, in which all the victims have one thing in common. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will the fury over the killing of George Floyd change anything for black people in America? When Paul Butler sees what's happening in America now, he sees it from the perspective of someone who has experienced the country's criminal justice system from pretty much every angle, as a prosecutor, an academic, an activist, a black man, and as a writer who 3 years ago published a book called Chokehold about the violent history of the police technique that resulted in George Floyd's death. The racism that he believes underpins the entire system is something he's experienced ever since childhood.
What happened to you as a child?
Which time? So, I mean, you know, we could talk about me riding my bike to the library, which was across the tracks, literally across the tracks. When Martin Luther King came to Chicago, where I grew up, he said it was the most segregated city he'd ever seen. He said it was more segregated than Birmingham, Alabama. And sure enough, the only library that I could get to from my Black neighborhood was miles away in the white neighborhood. And this cop car pulls up next to me. Officer rolls down the window, white guy. Is that your bike? I was a smart ass even then. I said, yes. Is that your car? And I sped away. When I got home, I told my mom what I'd said. This is a woman who marched with Martin Luther King and with Malcolm X.
But if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live.
I kind of thought she'd be proud. She gave me a spanking. Don't I know what happens to Black boys who talk to the cops like that? And it turns out she was correct. We know now that the Chicago Police Department at the same time was literally operating an off-site where they would take Black men and torture them until they confessed the crimes that they didn't commit. They would attach electrodes to their genitals. They would pour soda up their nostrils. My mother's spanking, it's one of those times when, one of those spankings when the parent cries as much as the child. She had to teach me a hard lesson. And the lesson took. So my life's work has been about trying to make the system better.
So Paul studied law and became a prosecutor in Washington, D.C.
I'd gone into the prosecutor's office as an undercover brother. And I hoped that by being a prosecutor, I could make the system work better. I could create change from within. But what I found is that rather than change the system changed me. I was a prosecutor in the District of Columbia. I represented the government in criminal court. And I use that power to put Black men in prison. If you go to criminal court in the District of Columbia, you would think that white people don't commit crimes. You'd think that white people don't use drugs. They don't get in a fight. They don't steal. Even though they're about 40% of the population of the city at that time, they were utterly absent from the criminal court. But Black people, man, you would say those are some bad dudes. So in the 1990s, when I was doing this work in D.C., there was a study that was released that said that half of the Black men, the young Black men in D.C., was in the criminal legal system. They either were in prison or jail, they were on probation, or they were awaiting trial. Half of young Black men. We're in the system.
And then suddenly Paul found himself as part of that statistic.
I got arrested and prosecuted for a crime that I didn't commit. It was a silly little misdemeanor. It was a dispute about a parking space between a neighbor and me. She called the police and said that I'd run up to her and pushed her. And it was totally silly. And so they arrested me, even though there was no evidence that I was guilty. You know, people ask, well, when the cops rolled up, did you tell them you were a prosecutor? You bet I did. And the cops said, well, you probably already know this. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can or will be held against you. When the police officer saw me, he didn't see a law graduate. He didn't see anything but my black skin. And police work is rounding up the usual suspects. The usual suspects are black men. And so that's the work that he did. Things worked out fine for me. The reason things worked out fine for me is because I had the best lawyer in town. Things worked out fine for me is because I had legal skills. The reason things worked out for me is because I had social standing. During the trial, we made sure the jurors knew things that should have been totally irrelevant, but that would make a difference. So we let them know, yeah, I went to Harvard Law School. I went to Yale for college. I was a prosecutor with the United States Department of Justice. And finally, the reason things worked out fine for me is because I was innocent. But at the end of the day, that didn't seem like the most important reason. What I said about that experience is that it made a man out of me. It made a black man out of me.
Because you saw at that moment the injustice that black men faced in that system.
Absolutely. A lot of things that defendants who I prosecuted said to me happened to me. I guess it is kind of poetic justice. When I was prosecuting young black men, one defense would be, well, the police are lying. And as a prosecutor, I would get up in their face on cross-examination, and I'd say, Mr. Jones, you mean this officer has nothing to do but make up stories about you? Give me a break. During my own trial, the prosecutor took the stand and he lied his ass off. What I learned, both on an intellectual level, of being a prosecutor, just spending day after day locking up black folks. And then on a very emotional, personal level, getting locked up myself and going to trial myself, was that this was not only work that I couldn't do, but to the extent I thought I was helping out my community, I was wrong. I was just making things worse. That's when I started teaching, writing, researching, and that's also led me to activism.
Coming up, why the video of George Floyd's death outraged Paul, but didn't surprise him. Paul, when I see that video of George Floyd having his life squeezed out of him, I know that it comes on the back of a long and troubled history in terms of the police and black men in America. But I hadn't actually considered the history of the technique that is used. 3 years ago, you wrote a book about the injustices facing black men when it comes to policing, and you named it Chokehold. So actually, what we've all seen is nothing new. It's something that has been repeated throughout the history of the US.
It's 400 years old. It's as old as the African-American presence in the United States. It's as old as policing in the United States, which evolved from slave patrol. So policing has always been about control of black people. And because it's come from slavery, there are some practices that are inherently cruel. And unfortunately, consistent. And so to that extent, I shouldn't have been surprised. My book, Chokehold, is named to remember a man named Eric Garner.
I did nothing. We sitting here the whole time, out of our business.
Who, a few years before the police used that neck restraint on Mr. Floyd, they used it on Mr. Garner. And Mr. Garner's crime was selling a single tobacco cigarette. They're called Lucy's. And they're available for people who can't afford a whole carton. It's not legal because they're untaxed.
Everybody's standing here, they told you I didn't do nothing. I did not sell nothing. Because every time you see me, you want to harass me, You would stop me trying to sell a cigarette? I'm minding my business, officer. I'm minding my business. Please just leave me alone. I told you the last time. Please just leave me alone.
And so the cop was arresting him for that. The cop thought Mr. Garner was resisting. He pushed him to the ground and put him in a chokehold, and Mr. Garner died.
Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave, calling out the violence of the racist police. We're not gonna stop till people are free.
Again, it's the same situation. So I shouldn't have been surprised. In a way, I'm glad that I was shocked when I saw the video of Mr. Floyd, because we shouldn't lose our capacity for outrage. We should never get used to that kind of cruelty, especially from the state, especially from the people, the cops who are supposed to serve and protect. And so if it happens again next week, and it will happen, I still want to be shocked. That's part of my humanity, because if I think, well, that's just how police treat Black men, then I'm diminished as a person.
And your thesis is that it's not just a physical thing, that the chokehold is actually symbolic of something bigger.
The chokehold is what police call a pain compliance technique. So they use it when they're trying to force you to do what they want, but it doesn't work. You can't do what they want because you cannot breathe. And in a way, that seemed like a good metaphor for the experience of African-American men in the United States, and especially our experience with the criminal justice system.
But what you're basically telling me is that these injustices don't just date back a few years. They don't just date back a couple of decades. They date right back through time, and yet they keep happening again and again. And part of that is the very specific thing you've talked about, the chokehold. None of this is new. So why did what happened to George Floyd trigger such a dramatic response?
I think because of the video. So for the people who don't believe that the police could do that, what the video reveals is that, yes, they can, and yes, they do. The other reason, though, is cumulative. In the last 4 weeks, what we've learned is that in the United States of America, in Georgia, a Black man can't jog.
10 weeks after an armed father-son duo chased down a jogging Ahmaud Arbery and shot him to death.
I ran for Ahmaud.
People have been running for Ahmaud on what would have been his 26th birthday.
Put a white t-shirt on, because that was the color t-shirt he wore.
It's our freedom to be able to go out and run. We shouldn't be hunted down or anything like that.
In Kentucky, a Black woman can't sleep in her bed.
911, operator Harris, where is
your
emergency?
I don't know what's happening. Somebody kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend.
Okay, where are you located?
I'm at 3003 Springfield Drive, apartment 4.
3003 Springfield Drive, apartment number 4?
Yes. My God.
Okay, how old is your girlfriend?
She's 26. Bring it.
You said 26. Where was she shot at?
I don't know. She's on the grill right now. I don't know.
Okay.
Mama.
You said she's 26. Is she alert and able to talk to you?
No, she's not. Breathe.
Breonna Taylor, who was a first responder. The police looking for drugs that her boyfriend allegedly had, burst in her house in the middle of the night, shot her dead in her bed. But we've learned that in Central Park, New York, a Black man can't birdwatch.
Please stop. Sir, I'm asking you to stop.
Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to
asking you to stop recording.
Please don't come close to me.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
I'm taking a picture and calling the cops.
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
Without the cops being called.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately. I'm in Central Park in the Ramble. I don't know.
Thank you.
And then finally in Minneapolis, we learned that a black man can't breathe. And so I think learning that the black man can't breathe was just too much.
I'm tired of my black men and my black women being shot, being killed by the NYPD. I'm tired of it. I have three black men in my home. I'm tired. My black brothers and sisters are being shot, being killed for no reason.
The way how they treated George Floyd on the streets, man, is definitely one of the most brutal, one of the most inhuman things I've seen on this planet.
We treat animals better than we treat black lives in this country. We are tired of officers being able to literally get away with murder.
And what we're doing right now in these protests, in these moments, as we risk ourselves in this pandemic, is fighting for humanity. We're fighting for humanity right now, and we're asking everyone all over the world to stand with us and fight with us.
I need everybody, if you black, white, green, or orange, I don't give a fuck what color you are. Tell your friends, tell your brothers and sisters, we will not win this fight with guns. It's not gonna happen. We gotta be peaceful.
What I need y'all to do right now on the 16th is come up with a better way. Cause how we doing it, it ain't working. He angry at 46. I'm angry at 31. You angry at 16. So, putting yourself in harm's way is not the way.
No, it's not.
And it is your duty not to burn your own house down for anger with an enemy. Now is the time to plot, plan, strategize, organize, and mobilize.
So I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of the narratives. I'm tired of the hashtags. How many hashtags will we have? We just want to live.
It's like we can't talk, we can't breathe, we can't walk, we can't sleep, we can't do anything, we can't drive without being in fear.
From slavery to Jim Crow to black codes to mass incarceration to police brutality, at the end of the day, it is the killing and the destruction of the black body in this community. And it's really just about time that we stand up.
This isn't the first video. Was there something particularly striking about this video?
Mr. Floyd literally tells the story of his death for 7 minutes. And then he goes silent. And, you know, I talked about my mom giving me a spanking when I talked back to the police. It's called the talk. It's a thing in the United States. Every parent of a black child or a brown child tells her kid, this is how you act around the police. You got to be respectful because you don't know what they're going to do. We see a version of that as Mr. Floyd lies dying. He says, officer. He says, please, please. He invokes his dead mother. He's being as respectful as a person can be when you're trying to appeal for mercy to people who are literally crushing your life away. And yet it still doesn't work. That respect doesn't work. And so I think that also hit people in a very real way. Like, what is it that you can do? And so I can't breathe. It's literal in the context of Mr. Floyd, but it also seems really expressive, really symbolic in another way that black folks, brown folks, we feel like we can't breathe.
And one of the things that shocked me most of all was the fact that there were people standing there yards away filming it, shouting, asking them to stop. This is the age of social media. Those police officers must have realized that everything that they were doing was being captured. Why would that not have stopped them?
White privilege is an extremely powerful drug. People ask this all the time. Like, well, all these videos come out about cops abusing black people. So you think at a point, a police officer would learn, I need to be careful because if I beat this person up, it's going to be on video. And yet they still do it. I thought we saw a really dramatic example of that on Friday.
And this is a scene here playing out in Minneapolis. This is part of the advanced police presence that we saw come over the
this reporter, dark-skinned young guy who identifies as African-American and Hispanic, is live on CNN reporting about the protest rally, and these uniformed officers, a bunch of them, just kind of march up to him and say,
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
You're under arrest. And he asked, well,
do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir? Why am I under arrest, sir?
Okay.
Why? And they don't say anything. They don't give him an explanation. And he's wearing a mask, so the only thing you could see are his eyes. His eyes are terrified. His eyes are perplexed. He has to talk, right? And so he's extremely polite. He says, officer, I'll go wherever you want me to go. I don't want to be in the way. Just tell me what to do. They put him in handcuffs and lead him away. And then they come back and arrest the other three members of his crew.
That is an American television reporter, Omar Jimenez, being led away by police officers. He clearly identified himself as a reporter. He was respectfully explaining to the state police that our CNN team was there and moving away as they would request.
Meanwhile, in the same area, there was a white CNN reporter, and he says, the police saw me there, and they just said, you know, you're going to have to move because this is our area. And he says, okay, well, can I, you know, he wants to stay around because he's reporting. And so, you know, they come up and say, okay, you can't go there, you can go here. The way that he describes the experiences.
Have you been approached by police where you're standing?
No, I can tell you that my experience has been the opposite of what Omar just experienced there.
It's the opposite. It's the opposite of what happened to the black reporter.
Permitted to be in this area. As a vehicle came by, they asked me to step outside of, you know, outside of the street, which I did. And I, you know, asked them if I can move back in. They said, yeah, you're good to go.
And when I was thinking about the U.S. criminal legal process, it's almost a cliche now that we have two different justice systems, separate and unequal. But I decided, I like the word that that white reporter used. We have opposite systems of justice in the United States. We have one for white folks, and we have another one for people of color, especially black and Hispanic people. And this is literally on TV. And so the question again is, if you're policing a rally about police brutality and police discrimination, and you know you're on TV, you really don't want to treat a black person differently than a white person. You don't want to arrest a black person when you wouldn't arrest a white person. I can almost imagine a roll call before this rally. A roll call is where police get instructions for the day. I could almost imagine the sergeant saying, okay, guys, we're going to be policing a rally about police brutality. Don't be racist today. Don't be brutal today. But it still didn't work. I can't explain why they would do that when they know they're being filmed, other than there must be something that's so powerful about this need to treat black people differently.
But what we're seeing, the difference in the treatment between Omar Jimenez and Josh Campbell, or what happened to George Floyd, or what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, it isn't just about the justice system, is it? What you're saying is it's about something much bigger within American society that runs throughout society.
There's been a long debate in the United States about how central whiteness is to the identity of the country. So Michelle Obama used to always say the White House was built by slaves. The Capitol was built by slaves. What's the meaning of that? And is there some way that that meaning echoes in the present? Is there something about white supremacy that's fundamental to the identity of the United States? President Obama, he has this ongoing debate with a writer named Ta-Nehisi Coates. Same question. Coates said, if we were to be a truly egalitarian society, we wouldn't be recognizable as the United States. That theory is that there's something that's central about whiteness to being American, and that people who aren't white will always be second-class citizens.
And right now, that white privilege you're talking about feels like it runs all the way up to the president in a very powerful way.
I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters. But in recent days, our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa, and others. A number of state and local governments have failed to take necessary action to safeguard their residents. These are not acts of peaceful protest. These are acts of domestic terror.
This weekend, the president tweeted that the people who were protesting in front of the White House should be met with vicious dogs. He bragged about the Secret Service agents. He said, there's some young guns, some young officers who just itching to fight. And he said, looters should be shot. So this is nostalgia for a white supremacist, an overtly white supremacist era when civil rights activists were in fact met with fire hoses and vicious dogs and shoot to kill orders.
You've talked about the action itself fitting into a story of repetition, the same thing happening again and again. We've talked about how big this reaction is, but is there a risk that it also falls into that same story of repetition, or do you think that this could be a turning point, that it could somehow be different to the past?
I hope it's a turning point, but I doubt it.
Why?
You made me feel old earlier when you said I'd been a prosecutor decades ago. But I guess you're right. And I guess as an African-American man, as a scholar of the criminal legal process, I've been here before. Rodney King, back in the 90s, there was that dramatic videotape of the police wilding out on him. People said, well, that's going to make a difference. And we could go right through the decades, through Ferguson a few years ago, and everyone says, well, this is the turning point, and it turns out the point doesn't turn. There are incremental signs of progress. So after Ferguson and all of the police violence during the Obama administration, he put together a task force that came up with some very constructive recommendations about ways that police can do better. And when Trump entered the White House, he put those recommendations in the garbage can. And so if there's another administration, again, there could be reform that comes from the top down, from the federal government down, that puts in place best practices. It's not like we don't know. There's lots of ways to make police act better, treat people more fairly, and keep communities safer. We know lots of ways that police can do better. It's just that they don't. I guess that's why I'm not real optimistic.
You say you know how to fix this. Can it ever be fixed?
It can be fixed. So when we think about the different issues, part of it is culture. The problem now is that police think of themselves as warriors. It's us against them, and them are the people of the United States who they're supposed to serve and protect. And we certainly saw evidence of that warrior mentality this past weekend with the way that the police responded to protests with the flash grenades and the tear gas. Guardian, President Obama suggested, is the better model. And if you think about the kind of person who wants to be a guardian, that's very different from the kind of person who wants to be a warrior. So that culture change is really significant. There's some more policy-focused interventions to ban racial profiling, for example. When police do kill somebody, to have independent investigations. I could go on and on, but I think you kind of get the point. One concern that I have, though, is that when the police were literally crushing the life out of Mr. Floyd, one of the bystanders says to the officers, "He's human, bro." But Mr. Floyd was not human to these officers. A lot of African-American and Hispanic people are not human to many police officers. And I don't know how you fix that.
Paul Butler, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you.
That was Paul Butler. Do go to theguardian.com to read his comment pieces, including one this weekend. He's written a number of books, including Chokehold, Policing Black Men, that I mentioned. That was actually featured in a Guardian series in 2017. Do take a look. Our team from Guardian US will continue to report on this story. Derek Chauvin, the officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, has been charged with third-degree murder and will appear in court next week. Three other police officers present at the scene have been fired and remain under investigation. Protests continue across the country, some marred by violence and looting. President Trump has threatened to deploy the US military. Read all of the coverage at theguardian.com. Do also have a look at the Guardian video, It's About Time We Stand Up, that includes a montage of the protests, some of which we have included in this piece. And if you get a chance, listen to our Today in Focus episode on the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. That's it for today. My thanks to Paul Butler. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.